We're going to start the last of the procedures, I mean the last of the overall projects today, but just do the first part of it. So the rest of the term we'll be working on this PGLO thing in one way or another. This first part not only is the shortest part of the PGLO things that we're doing, but it's the shortest procedure in all the semester. So I don't know whether I can fill the remaining time by speaking for 2 hours or not, but I'll give it a shot. I'm not actually going to fill all the time, but I do want to talk about it because this is the one that you write up completely. Well, just as I want you to, I mean, just as you probably want to write as good a paper, I want you to write as good a paper because it's much less torturous reading papers by people who know what they're talking about than it is by people who try to make it seem like they know what they're talking about. So let me explain some things having to do with tonight's stuff. First, I want to distinguish between vertical gene transfer and horizontal gene transfer. Have you heard these terms? All right, then you want to explain the difference? What is vertical gene transfer?
One is when it's in the same, one's in the next family and one's in the same family, I guess.
By family, you don't mean family. You don't mean family above genus. The taxon family.
No,
anyone else want to give it a shot? Vertical gene transfer is the kind of the usual way that you tend to think about gene transfer, meaning that it's transfer of genes from a parent to its offspring. All right. Now I say parent there because it could be asexual or sexual. Bacteria, which we're using in the experiment, are asexual organisms. So there's only one parent. And when gene transfer because of reproduction is vertical gene transfer. And whether that reproduction is sexual or asexual, a parent transfers genes to its offspring. So that's the usual way of thinking about how genes get transferred from an organism to another organism. It's not the only way, though, to distinguish it from vertical gene transfer. We call any other method horizontal gene transfer. So in horizontal gene transfer, there is transfer of genes from some organism to some other organism that is not the offspring of the first organism. Not only is it not the offspring, it might not be very highly related at all. It could be even in a different domain. So as distantly related as possible. And by the way, horizontal gene transfer, which happens naturally, makes the job of figuring out the tree of life, which is what phylogenetic specialists are busy doing. They're always redrawing the tree based on incoming evidence. You know, that doesn't drastically change, but it changes at the fine details, at the species level and genus level and so on. Anyway, drawing that tree based, finding the information necessary to draw that tree is itself hard enough. But horizontal gene transfer makes it even harder because then now you get DNA that's comes from somewhere else and therefore makes it look like it was in the lineage before because of vertical gene transfer. Well, it's not always because of vertical gene transfer. But anyway, that's the distinction, and I bring that up because bacteria have three mechanisms of horizontal gene transfer that they use in nature, one of which is the subject of today's exercise. What are the three kinds of bacterial horizontal gene transfer mechanisms? Anyone know? Transformation is one, and that's the one we'll investigate tonight, or actually more than investigate it, we're going to try to make it happen. What else?
Conjugation
is a second. And what about number three? Transduction, yes. Transformation, transduction, conjugation. Let's quickly define each of these. Transformation is the uptake by a bacterium of naked DNA. And by naked, I mean that DNA is no longer in a cell, or maybe it was never in a cell. In the case of a virus, for instance, viral DNA is not part of a cell naturally because a virus isn't an organism. But no matter what, where the DNA was originally, it is naked if it's not in a cell. Maybe a cell died and lysed as part of its death and spilled out its DNA, whatever. DNA is out there as just junk, basically. And under the right circumstances, which isn't very often, actually, in terms of a percentage, but under the right circumstances, a bacterium can take up that naked DNA into its cell and start using it as though it were its own DNA. In other words, naked DNA can be carrying some genes, and once that naked DNA gets transformed once the bacterium transforms by taking up that naked DNA, any genes that are contained on it could be transcribed by the bacterium, and then the messenger RNA that results could be translated into whatever the corresponding protein is. That's transformation. Transduction is a little bit similar, but is a little bit more involved because it involves a virus in the process. It's not just naked DNA, it's viral DNA that gets injected into a bacterium. What do we call a virus that invades a bacterium? A bacteriophage, right. And usually, under normal circumstances, it's just the viral DNA that gets injected into the bacterium, which is bad for the bacterium. Often will kill it. But sometimes mistakes get made, and that viral DNA could become incorporated. Not only could the bacterium survive it, but the viral DNA could be incorporated into the chromosome of the bacterium, and then later it could come back out, and by mistake it could bring some bacterial DNA along with it. And if that viral DNA then gets processed like normal viral DNA does, meaning packaged into new viruses, those new viruses are carrying viral DNA plus a little bit of bacterial DNA with them. And if they go infect another bacterium, and those bacteria survive that viral attack, they could be receiving DNA from another bacterium that they got via a virus. And so that's transduction. Conjugation, the third type of horizontal gene transfer, involves two bacterial cells, one of which is a donor cell and one of which is a recipient. And it's the closest that bacteria come to mating, even though it's not sexual. The donor cell will produce what's called either a conjugation tube or a sex pilus. Pilus means hair. Just looks like a hair, of course. It's not really hair. And unlike hair, it's not a rod, it's a tunnel, really. The conjugation tube is a tunnel that connects the two bacteria temporarily and allows for the passage of DNA from the donor to the recipient. What form of DNA gets transferred via conjugation? What do we call the little pieces of DNA that get transferred through the conjugation tube? F what? Well, that's a specific example, but what is it an example of? A plasmid, yes. Plasmids get transferred via conjugation. The donor, before it transfers it, will replicate it, save a copy for itself, send the other copy to the other one, and now they both have the plasmid, which can then be replicated again. Okay, so those are the three methods, and like I said, transformation is what we're going to try to have happen tonight, but one important part of this overall exercise is that it reminds us of what we've already talked about, which is that DNA does not directly give an organism its traits, right? What does? Proteins, right. You have your traits. You look, smell, feel the way you do, though you think the way you do because of the particular proteins that your cells are able to make. But even though there's effectively no limit to the number of types of proteins that can be made, the only ones that your cells know how to make are the ones they have instructions for, and that's what the DNA is in the case of protein coding genes. So definitely your DNA is involved in your traits, but it doesn't directly give them to you. It directly allows for the production of certain messenger RNAs, which then get translated into proteins. Those proteins directly give you your traits. Okay, now, we mentioned plasmids a little bit ago. What is a plasmid? Right. It's a circular piece of double-stranded DNA, but I'm glad you used the word smaller, because so is a bacterial chromosome, right? Prokaryotic cells have circular chromosomes, generally just one chromosome. But that bacterial chromosome is much bigger than a plasmid, and therefore contains many more genes than a plasmid would. The genes that are on the bacterial chromosome are the necessary genes that that bacterium requires in order to make the necessary proteins to survive as a bacterium. A plasmid has many fewer genes, but you can think of these as extra genes because the plasmid isn't necessary for the bacterium to survive under normal situations. But if the plasmid is present, then the bacterium has additional traits because it has additional genes and therefore can produce additional proteins that its chromosome doesn't code for. And those extra proteins gives it extra traits. All right? So these plasmids occur in nature. Like I said, they get transferred during conjugation, but nowadays we also engineer them to carry specific genes coding for proteins that we're interested in. And we cause transformation to occur so that we can force, basically, bacteria to produce whatever protein we want them to produce for us. This is how insulin is made nowadays, right? It wasn't long ago that insulin for diabetic humans was isolated from the pancreas of hogs that got slaughtered for meat. Nowadays, we just co-opt bacteria and have them do the work for us. We transform them with a plasmid that has the gene for insulin. Once that plasmid is in the bacterium, all we need to do is keep the bacterium well fed. It'll make many, many more bacteria with that same plasmid and therefore will produce insulin for us. Insulin's just an example, but we are going to work with a plasmid that is engineered that includes different genes, but we're going to cause this transformation to happen, hopefully. Like I said before, transformation does not occur readily. So just a tiny, tiny fraction of the overall bacterial cells, which are E. coli in your case, only a tiny fraction of the ones that you're going to expose to the plasmid and therefore are potentially transformable will actually transform. Most of them still will not take up the plasmid. Only a very small percentage of them will. But as long as some do, that's enough, because once you have a transformed bacterium, when that bacterium divides into two new bacteria by binary fission, the plasmid will be in both of those daughter cells. Okay? Now let's take a look at, well, first of all, what is PGLO? That's the major theme of the rest of the term, right? All these remaining meetings will be about PGLO in one way or another. What is PGLO? No. We're going to talk about that, though. That's not what PGLO is, though. Any guesses as to what the P in PGLO stands for? It's a good guess. Plasmid, the very thing we've been talking about. PGLO is the plasmid that we're working with tonight. That's what we're going to try to get into the bacteria. So, we have a schematic representation of PGLO on the screen here. This circle of DNA, much smaller than the bacterial chromosome, and therefore doesn't have all that many genes. In fact, there are three genes shown here in green. Just the green arrows are gene. The ORI here, that just stands for the origin of replication. Just like the chromosome has an origin of replication where replication begins, a plasmid also does. Plasmids, just like chromosomes, can be replicated. That's why binary fission will produce two bacteria, each with the plasmid, when you start with one that has the plasmid originally. Okay, now, let me talk about these three genes. One is the gene that's labeled BLA, and the arrows indicate the direction of transcription. Remember, a gene can be described, can occur on either of the two strands, and therefore transcription can occur in either direction depending on which strand the gene is on. But this BLA gene, why is it called that? What does the BLA stand for? Anyone know? It stands for beta-lactamase. Now, what sort of thing is beta-lactamase? Based on linguistics. An enzyme, right, an A's ending. Beta-lactamase is an enzyme, therefore a protein, and therefore that, what's labeled BLA, is not BLA, right? BLA is the protein that that a bacterium with this plasmid is able to produce if it first transcribes this BLA gene and then translates the BLA messenger RNA into BLA itself. Remember, there are two parts to protein synthesis. Transcription first, which is the only part that involves the DNA. That produces the messenger RNA, which is now carrying the code. DNA's job is done. And then translation, which uses the code in the messenger RNA at a ribosome to assemble the polypeptide, which is the final product. In this case, that product would be beta-lactamase itself, the protein that acts as an enzyme called beta-lactamase. The reason this is a nifty thing for the bacterium to be able to make is because beta-lactamase confers antibiotic resistance to the bacterium. Antibiotics are agents that normally kill bacteria. And there are different kinds of antibiotics. Beta-lactamase allows the bacterium to survive specifically ampicillin and some other related antibiotics. And that's why ampicillin is part of today's overall process as well. Okay? That's one gene, and the promoter, which is the end at the beginning of the arrow, not the arrowhead, the other end, the promoter is, of course, where transcription starts. That particular promoter is always available for RNA polymerase, which means RNA polymerase can always join to that promoter, which means that gene can always be transcribed. In other words, the BLA gene is an example of a gene that's always turned on, which is not the case for most genes, right? What is the name that we give to a gene that is always turned on? You heard this? Well, that describes it, but it's not the term. The term is constitutive. A constitutive gene is always being transcribed. This isn't the normal case, right? Consider your own body, your multicellular organism. Each one of your cells, though, has the same DNA. So, the cells in your skin cells have the code for how to build kidney enzymes. But this, you don't want that to happen, right? So, a lot of your genes are turned off, only certain ones are turned on in different parts of the body and at different times within one cell, depending on the need for those proteins. Same with a single-celled organism like a bacterium. But there are some constitutive genes. Normal constitutive genes would be calling for something that you always need that protein. But you can also have a gene malfunction. Something can go wrong and turn it into a constitutive gene, in which case that's bad, right? Because you wouldn't want to always be making the protein if you don't need it always. Anyway, that's what constitutive means, and this BLA gene in this P-GLO plasmid is constitutive. Therefore, if the P-GLO plasmid has successfully entered a bacterium, if it's successfully transformed, then it will continuously be making beta-lactamase, and therefore will continuously be able to survive ampicillin. Now, the other two genes are shown by the other two arrows, and notice they're going in opposite directions as far as transcription direction is concerned. But they share a beginning point. They share a promoter, in other words, the little black space between them. This is a common theme in bacterial genetics. Bacteria group related genes together, and by related I mean genes that code for proteins that, although they're different proteins, they're all needed at the same time for a common task. They group them together so that they all share one promoter. And therefore, all of those genes are either turned on and transcribed at once, or they're all turned off at the same time. Because you either need all of them or you don't need any of them at the moment. What do we call such a group of genes that share one promoter in a bacterium? I don't know whether you've discussed them this in 347 yet or not, but you should have learned about them in 181. Maybe. I can't remember 181. It's been a while since I've taught 181. It's called an operon. So you've probably heard of like the lac operon, which is usually the first one taught because it was the first one discovered and elucidated. Okay, well, what we have here is a setup, an artificial setup of an operon. The ARAC gene, that is one of the naturally occurring genes that is a member of what's called the ARA operon. What does ARA here stand for? Arabinose. And what sort of thing is arabinose? It is a sugar. That's not a sugar, that's DNA. But it's a member of the arabinose or ARA operon because if arabinose as a sugar is going to be used as a fuel, in other words, if it needs to be metabolized by the bacterium, there are several different proteins that are going to be required to be able to do that job of using it as fuel. And you need all of them. If you're going to need any of them, you're going to need all of them. But you're not going to want to make any of those proteins if you don't have any arabinose present, because that would be a waste, right? And that's why, in the absence of arabinose, all that whole operon will be turned off. If arabinose is present, the one promoter that they all share will be activated, and therefore all of those genes will be transcribed at the same time. That occurs normally in the chromosome of a bacterium, but that's part of the engineering of the plasmid here. Instead of the rest of the genes that are in the normal operon, though, we've replaced the other part with a different gene here labeled as GFP. What does GFP stand for? No guesses? Green fluorescence protein. Yes. And so the thing there labeled GFP is not GFP. Because that thing labeled there is not a protein, right? GFP is a protein. That is called the GFP gene, which is not GFP. But the gene tells the cell how to build GFP itself. So it's the protein that actually fluoresces, meaning that it glows under ultraviolet radiation. Where did this gene get taken from naturally? A jellyfish, Aquaria victoria, which is a jellyfish, has this naturally in its genome. We took it out of the jellyfish, engineered it into this plasmid in such a way that its promoter is the same promoter from the ARA operon, and therefore these two genes, ARAC and GFP, do not work constitutively. They're controlled like normal genes are. They get turned on and off. What is it that turns them both on? Arabinose, the sugar, correct. So, assuming that a plasmid gets actually taken up by the successfully transformed bacterium, that will give it this genetic capability. But just having the plasmid does not make the bacterium glow, right? It's not going to glow unless it uses that GFP gene to actually produce GFP itself, the protein. Okay? Now let's talk about your plates. You have four plates that come in three types. And you need to refer to the key that's on this whiteboard corresponding to the little tick marks that are on your plates to determine what the ingredients are in each. They look the same gel-wise, but they're different. So make sure you're using the right plates. One of them with just the blue is called the LB plate because all it has as far as what we're going to talk about in the gel is LB, which is food basically for the bacteria. They're well fed, and when you well feed bacteria, they will, in the case of this species, undergo binary fission about every 20 minutes, which means the population will double every 20 minutes, and that quickly adds up, or multiplies up, really. So you start with an invisible number of bacteria that, when you look at them later on, since they're well fed, will be millions and millions of copies of them, which will appear as colonies. Each colony represented one bacterium in that place originally that just kept undergoing binary fission. So anyway, any kind of E. coli should grow on the LB plate, whether it's transformed or not, right? And therefore, if you plate out bacteria that you've exposed to the P. globe plasmid, like I said, only a little bit of those will actually transform. The rest of them will still be wild type. But they'll both grow on LB. So you won't be able to tell whether those bacteria have transformed or not. What about if you shine an ultraviolet light on them, though? Will any of them glow? No, and why not? They do. Some of them do have the gene for it. But there's no arabinose, so the gene is remaining off, and they therefore don't make the GFP protein. Okay, next, in red letters here, is the LB amp plate. That has food, but it also has ampicillin, which kills wild-type bacteria that don't have this plasmid in addition to their own bacterial chromosome. This is useful because when we do a transformation experiment, we would like to know which ones actually got transformed and which ones didn't. Especially if we want to use those transformed ones, we want to have just a pure colony of only transformed ones to work with, right? So the ampicillin is used as a way to filter out the ones that do not transform. You put a suspension of bacteria that have been exposed to the P. globe plasmid onto an LB amp plate, and the ones that didn't successfully take up the P. globe plasmid are going to die because they're not immune to the ampicillin. The ones that take up the P. globe plasmid, though, will survive because the BLA gene is constitutive Therefore, they're always making beta-lactamase, which is what gives them the resistance to the ampicillin. What about if you light that with UV? Still no glowing, because the other two genes, which includes the GFP gene, will be turned off since there's no ampicillin. And therefore, the final plate, which has LB, AMP, and ARA, the only things growing on that should be successfully transformed bacteria, because they survived the ampicillin. But you've also provided the sugar switch that turns on the GFP gene, and therefore they should be making GFP, the protein, which is what allows them to glow, and therefore those ones, when illuminated with UV, should glow. Everyone clear on all that? Okay, in that case, it's a matter of very carefully following instructions so you can get as good results as possible. I think it tells you to pick up a single colony from your other plate that you're using as a source of E. coli. It doesn't have to be a single colony. Just scoop up a goodly portion of bacteria without gouging into the gel. You want to pick up just the bacteria. But too much is not a problem, so don't worry about it. And we're the last group, so we don't even have to leave any for anyone else. The P-Glow plasmid itself is in one, it looks like. One vial that you'll probably say, this is almost empty, can we get a full one? No, this is a full one. This is all you get in the kit. But this is billions of copies of P-Glow plasmid. You only need enough to dip your little white loops into at the small end and get a film of that. Okay, so use that up here, though. Don't take this back. Put the stopper back on and keep it on ice when you're done. Go ahead and do it.